Thank you to the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. I am one of the small select group, along with Dick Whedon, maybe Ron Kerman, who's in charge of making sure Eric is never the oldest person in the room. I'm going to talk about topless operators and Hankel forms on model spaces. I used to think about such math problems a long time ago, and then I more or less moved on to other things. But in the last bunch of years, first Michael Lacey and collaborators did some very nice things about Hankel forms on the polydisc. And then with Nicola and Brett Wick and Eric, we did some things on the Dirichlet space, and I've come back to my interest in these things, seeing them as part of a large interlacing program that I don't really understand but think has a lot of interesting mathematics in it. The material I'm going to talk about today is not particularly new. It's of the last 10, 15 years. The one novelty is I'm going to introduce Hankel forms into the discussion because what surprised me was how comfortably they fit and how much the fit resonated with other things I already had been thinking about. So, outline. I'll remind you what topless operators and Hankel forms are and what some of the classical results are without going very far in that. Model spaces are subspaces of the Hardy space on the unit circle, and I will tell you what they are and very, very briefly why they get studied. On these model spaces, these subspaces of the Hardy space, there are what could have been called tuplets operators, but they ended up being called truncated tuplets operators. And I'll tell you what they are and the analogous Hankel forms. It turns out the two theories are equivalent, which is interesting. All of these issues are in their youngish phase, and the issue of knowing, just given the operator that's clearly densely defined, knowing if it's bounded is, it's not clear how you go about doing that. Or if you know it's bounded, it's not clear you can find a particularly nice form of representation. That's what the bounded forms, bounded symbols are about. And then I've got some questions at the end. So, we're going to be doing function theory on the unit disk, and it's the Hardy theory, so we're going to be passing back and forth between realizations of functions as harmonic or holomorphic functions inside the circle and their boundary realization in, as a subspace of L2 in the circle. We need the projection P's, the Cauchy-Zagel projection, the orthogonal projection from the orthogonal projection from the Lebesgue space on the circle down to the Hardy space. We are not going to discuss any refined properties of inner functions, but inner functions are a basic part of the story. Let me remind you very briefly what an inner function is. It's a function in the Hardy space. It has modulus 1 almost everywhere on the boundary. And it, in fact, is a product of two things. B, the so-called Blaschke product, is a product possibly empty, possibly infinite, that tells you where the function, which I called phi, but seems to be called theta, where it has zeros. S is the so-called singular inner factor. It's determined by a positive singular measure mu on the boundary. And basically, mu gives you information about those points, regions where theta is decreasing rapidly to zero as you approach the boundary. Having said that, the structure of these things is incredibly rich, and all we need to know about it is that there are a few examples and that the general structure is incredibly rich. So, the model space, K. It's often called K. If you need to keep track of which inner function it's associated with, these are associated with inner functions, then we can put a sub theta. Some people write H2 sub theta. And anyhow, it's H2 orthogonal, it's the orthogonal complement H2 of theta times H2. And we denote by pk the projection onto it. Let me say a few words, and I'll say a few more later about why these things are studied independently of anything I'm going to be talking about today. Theta times h2 is the set of functions of the form theta times f, where f is an h2. That is a subspace of h2. It's a closed subspace, and it's invariant under multiplication by the coordinate functions. Work going back to Burling says that those are the only such invariant subspaces. And work in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s says that if you look on the orthogonal complement of that space, you get this thing theta, k theta, and a number of very non-trivial questions about operators on Hilbert space, general operators on Hilbert space, can be recast in terms of some relatively simple operators on the k theta, or variations of the k theta, namely vector value k thetas. So the Nagy-Floyash model theory is basically one of the distillations of that idea, and it's a very powerful tool. So these k thetas have been studied fairly extensively, and I'll just mention a little bit of that later. K is a reproducing kernel Hilbert space. In other words, K is a Hilbert space, and it's a Hilbert space of functions on a set. The set is the unit disk, at least, and the point evaluations are continuous. Given that the point evaluations are continuous, and that this is a Hilbert space, the evaluation functional is given by the inner product with something, and that's K zeta. And we have no use at all for the formula. The point of the formula is just that one can write down an explicit formula. This is the reproducing kernel for all zeta inside the disk. You can have bounded point evaluations in these spaces for some zeta on the boundary, in which case this formula becomes problematic, and we won't talk about what replaces it. This H2 theta is the closure of the smooth functions, of a certain space of smooth functions inside the Hardy space. You can take the same closure inside the Hardy space HP, and we'll call that HP sub theta. And this other description of it, I will try to remember to bring this slide up again. There's something going on in that other description. First of all, you just work it out and it works out okay. But there's something going on there that we want to talk about. So, classical background, Tuplets operators, Hankel operators. A Tuplets operator is an operator from the Hardy space H2 to itself, which is given by taking the function in the Hardy space, multiplying by a so-called symbol function C, and then projecting back to the Hardy space. This is a very classical object which has a whole family of modern generalizations and variations. And I just mentioned that. And in fact, to some extent, the work I'm talking about lives in that family of generalizations and variations. And there's a whole theory of these Tuplets operators. This is one of the basic places where function theory and operator theory interact. And a lot of the discussion is to relate the operator theory of T phi with the function theory of phi. For example, reading off from phi whether the operator is invertible, what its spectrum is, if it's Fredholm, what its index is, etc. The only fact I want right now is that the symbol and operator determine each other by that equation. And trivially, the L infinity norm of the symbol dominates the operator norm. And in fact, that's an equality. And I want to suggest that not only is it an equality, but that's not a deep statement. If you'd done the right things in class, you could give it as a homework exercise and actually expect most of the students to do it correctly. However, the reason I'm emphasizing that is there's going to be a result later that looks that clean, simple, and elegant, and in fact is a deep theorem. But that's later. There aren't any finite rank Tuplets operators in the Hardy space. But in other versions of Hardy space theory, in other variations, there are finite rank Tuplets operators. And in particular, in the version I'm going to be talking about, there are such, and that seems to be a basic part of the story, and we'll get to that later. Hankel forms. Again, these are classical. There's a certain set of decisions that have to be made when studying Hankel forms. The decisions are whether you want to regard the Hankel object as an operator a linear operator, in which case it naturally goes from a space to its dual, a certain space to its dual space, or a conjugate linear operator from the space to itself, or this is what I think works best. It's going to be defined to be a bilinear form with a characteristic property. And the characteristic property is the bilinear form of FG only depends on the product F times G. And it's clear that this means that you're going to be looking at the interaction between the algebraic structure of this collection of functions and the operator theory associated with B. And it also means that it's quite mechanical to see how you might try and generalize this definition to other contexts. Namely, you take a linear functional in space whose value only depends on the product of its arguments. Here, with the tuplet operators, the symbols are unique. So you say, if you know the symbol, what can you say about the operator and vice versa? Here, there's more than one symbol. Notice that modifying B by adding any conjugate holomorphic function of mean zero will not change the bilinear form. So you ask different questions about the symbols. And some things are clear. If B is bounded, then by the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, that bilinear form is bounded. If the bilinear form is bounded by the Hahn-Banach theorem, you can find a bounded B. So this works out. But these statements are, to some extent, skirting around what might be the more natural basic question, which is, suppose you take the natural symbol. You could argue it's not the natural symbol, but suppose you take the unique holomorphic B that gives this linear functional. And then you can ask, well, given that natural choice for B, how do you know if the bilinear form is bounded or not? It's again sufficient if B plus is bounded, but that's no longer necessary. And this brings us up to, I didn't look up the years, this brings us up to 1950-ish, and then the modern theory starts to develop. The modern theory is that a necessary and sufficient for that to be bounded is that B plus is an analytic BMO. I am not going to define that. It is a space of, A is for analytics, so it's a space of boundary values of holomorphic function characterized by an oscillation condition. It's a slightly bigger space than bounded functions. That statement is actually not actually a single clean statement. It's an amalgamation of several things, and different of these things generalize to different of the contexts in which Hankel forms are studied. First of all, let me define this guy. It's the set of sums of products, potentially infinite sums of products GIHI, where the GIHI are in H2. And the sum of the norm GI, norm HI product, and then sum in I, that sum is finite, and you norm this collection by the infimum of the sum on the right over all such representations of F. I would appreciate anyone who either knows for a fact what the correct name of this construction is or has a useful suggestion. It is, I believe, the restriction to the diagonal of the projective tensor product. That's not going to be its short, informal name. Anyhow, here's a construction. It is what it is. And by relatively straightforward functional analysis, the necessary and sufficient condition that HB plus B bounded is that B plus B in this space. I mean, we've set it up basically to say, if you're in this space, this is just wrong. And so what do you do here? You take a marker. I want the dual space. It should say, there should be a duality star there. Because the point is, these are products of things in H2 with norm control. A linear functional that's bounded on products of things in H2 will be bounded on each individual sum n, and hence on the entire sum. And I didn't put a duality star there, and maybe I won't do it on the screen. Now, that's a fancy sum. Soft analysis, relatively soft analysis, says that it's too fancy. You don't need an infinite sum. If you can do it, then you can do it with comparable norm with four sum ends. But in fact, in the classic theory of the Hardy space, you have the inner-outer factorization, and this thing is equal to H1, the Hardy space H1. And in fact, because of the inner-outer factorization, you don't need a sum. You can take any function in H1, right, it's just a product of two things in H2, so the norms work out okay. In other words, this relatively fancy construct isn't seen in the Hardy space theory because it's really not necessary, because you have the stronger and simpler result that comes from the inner-outer factorization. So what that gets you is that you want to look at a certain dual space, namely the dual of H2 circle H2, or the dual of H1, and then there's Fefferman's theorem that actually identifies the dual of H1 as this space BMOA. And there are two things I want to note about this. What it does, first of all, is it says this abstractly defined thing H1 star can be defined intrinsically as a space of functions, boundary values of holomorphic functions that satisfy a certain oscillation condition. And not the theorem as stated, but the whole machine that led up to it says that being in this space of bounded mean oscillation is intimately tied up with certain measure, certain statements about certain measures on the interior of the disk, the so-called Carlson measures. In other words, in addition to establishing that bounded mean oscillation functions are the dual of H1, in the theory leading up to this, there's also an identification of BMOA as those functions related to certain weighted embedding theorems. And in fact, weighted embedding theorems are one of the themes that shows up later. So we will see analogs of the first three, and the correct analog of the fourth one shows up toward the end as one of the questions. So, coming back to our model spaces. So we take an inner function, H2 minus theta H2, and we make a choice of theta to see what's going on. The simplest choice is theta is a monomial, z to the n plus 1. The ortho complement of that in the Hardy space are the polynomials of degree at most n. If theta is an interpolating Blaschke product, if theta is a Blaschke product whose zero corresponding to a zero set that's sufficiently scattered, then the individual, then in the quotient, the values of the functions in the quotient space at the points of the zero set are pretty much independent of each other. And if you don't care about the constants and the norm equivalents, you're just getting a space that's a naturally a weighted L2 space where the weight shows up naturally on the sequence of points where theta is zero. I said these inner functions had two factors, a product that told you where the functions were zero and a so-called singular inner function. The formula for the singular inner function is not so bad, and it's generated by just a point mass at the point one of size 2 alpha, then you can write down quite explicitly what the singular inner function looks like. And I don't want to do that. I just want to tell you that K is a reproducing kernel Hilbert space, and there's a natural, known forever, unitary map from that space to the Paley-Wiener space PW sigma. Not just a unitary map, they're Hilbert spaces, but there's a map from one Hilbert space to another that is compatible with the reproducing kernel structure. So PW sigma is the Paley-Wiener space, the subspace of L2 of the line of functions with Fourier transform supported on minus alpha alpha. Recall that H2 of the line is subspace of L2 consisting of functions with Fourier transform supported on zero infinity. So it's similar but different. But that previous slide was sort of phony. Inner functions are very complicated. There's very rich structure. It's very subtle. And those examples sort of don't point you to that. They sort of are the examples you find when you say, I don't want to see anything very complicated. So I'm not going to get involved in the detailed analysis of inner functions. I'm just going to tell you that there's a class of them which has been known for some time, which includes some rather sophisticated examples, but are still simple enough to be well behaved for our purposes. And that's the single component in our functions. Theta is a function of modulus less than or equal to 1 on the boundary. It's a modulus strictly less than 1 every point inside the disk. Think of the case where there are some zeros, so the set mod theta less than epsilon is certainly not going to be empty. And it's a question whether or not it's you can find an epsilon for which it's connected. For what we're talking about, the existence of the epsilon is the issue, not the size. And the fact that it's connected is not really what's at issue here. It's if it were two components, we'd be okay, or three. But the issue is these things can be extremely complicated, and what you should think of is this will include the points where theta is zero, and that those points can be scattered. Well, what are those points? It's any set of points inside the disk that satisfy the Blaschke condition, and that can be a very complicated, from a geometric point of view, can be a very complicated set. This theta z small set has to include that set, so it can be quite complicated. There's one fundamental new actor in this theory that you don't see in the classical Hardy space theory. Each one of these k thetas has a what's called a conjugation operator. Well, it has an operator associated with it called the conjugation operator. It depends on theta. You take a function f, you take its complex conjugate, you multiply by z bar, and then by theta. And now there's a mistake you might or might not make, and I made rather often, which is to misinterpret this formula. Here's what it does not mean. It does not mean that cf is the holomorphic function whose values inside are the values of those three factors inside. That statement up there is a statement about boundary values. The subtlety is you then have to find the holomorphic function that has those boundary values. And the theory associated with C, and there's not much at this level, is that that boundary value function is actually the boundary value of a holomorphic function, and in fact a holomorphic function k theta. So C is a conjugate linear involutive isometry. In other words, C squared is the identity, and the norm of CF is the norm of F. And those are elementary. Because norms of functions in H2 are determined by the modulus on the boundary, the isometric part is clear, and if you look at that formula, it's also clear that it's going to be an involution. There are certain class of operators that satisfy that CAC is a star. They're called symmetric with respect to that conjugation. We don't want to discuss symmetric operators at all, except to mention in passing that the tuplet type operators we will construct are symmetric. And I'm going to use CF whenever I do that thing on the boundary values. It shows up in some cases where we're outside of the Hilbert space. So, if theta is e to the n plus 1, then we've got polynomials of degree at most n. The C operator is conjugate linear. It takes the complex conjugates of the coefficients and flips the power of the monomial from a string going up to a string going down. Theta is that thing corresponding to the singular inner function with the point mass of size 2 alpha. In terms of the Pauli-Wiener space, this is the linear extension of the map that takes e to the az to e to the minus a bar z bar. And it's a little easier to see on the Fourier transform side. You're taking the Fourier transform of a function, conjugating it, and substituting minus xi for xi. Remember, the Fourier transform lives on an interval symmetric around the origin. So these are maps. Truncated tuplet operators. We fix theta, so we fix one of these model spaces. We take a symbol function on the circle. The truncated tuplet operator is the linear map that you get by, densely defined, multiplying by phi and projecting back onto the model space. In contrast to the classical theory, these symbols are not unique, which leads to a class of questions that we'll get to in a minute. But these things are symmetric. That's just an exercise with the definitions. They can be characterized intrinsically as the linear operators from K to itself, which if you take any functions fg, zf, zg, and k, zf is not automatically in k, nor is zg. But if you take four functions so they're everybody's in k, then this identity holds. This is the same form as the identity which characterizes classical tuplets operators. So these things were studied in the 80s by Mercovici, Poyash, Tannenbaum, and I did something. But those things sort of sat there, and in the late 90s, Don Saracen started a systematic study of what the properties of these things were and published a very nice paper which is the reason that nice paper is the reason the subject is getting a lot more attention now. So what do these operators look like? A tensor B is the rank one operator, which when applied to F is F inner product B times A. So KZ is the kernel function. C of KZ is the conjugate of the kernel function. That thing on top is a rank one operator. The thing in the next line is its adjoint. Those are both rank one truncated tuplets operators. Saracen has shown these are essentially the only ones. Essentially means other guys will be scalar multiples of these guys. And the structure of the general finite rank TTOs is not known, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So if I take theta z to the n plus 1, then I'm talking about a linear operator on the space of polynomials. And it's natural to just look at the matrix with respect to the monomial basis. A classic tuplets operator has matrix with respect to the monomial basis that's striped like that. One of these TTOs has a truncated tuplets matrix, exactly the same striping pattern, but you cut it off to make it n plus 1 by n plus 1. This formula is quite possibly wrong, not as wrong as the one that was on transparency yesterday. So we have this theta sub 2a. So we're going to get a linear operator in the Paley-Wiener space. Paley-Wiener space is things with Fourier transforms in minus AA. And instead of looking directly at the operator, we'll look at what the operator does on the Fourier transform side. So the multiplication by phi goes to convolution with phi hat, but we're only interested in what happens on minus AA, so I threw in that characteristic function. And without that characteristic function, but maybe with some other, or with a different characteristic function, these things are called Wiener-Hopf convolution operators, and they're unitarily equivalent to tuplets operators. So we're getting a variation on those. Truncated Hankel form. I want to do the same thing. I want to take my Hankel definition. So it's a bilinear form on K cross K, which depends only on the product of the arguments. So it's a linear functional of the product. So again, there's going to be a symbol function D, just because it's a linear functional, that space of holomorphic functions, a linear functional D which realizes the product. And again, there's an algebraic statement characterizing such bilinear forms. Bilinear form applied to ZFG is the same as FZG. Notice that is a special case of just saying that it only depends on the product of the two arguments. So here's the thing I think is interesting. The two theories, the tuplets operator theory and the Hankel operator theory on the Hardy space, are very independent. They're closely related, but they are independent theories in the sense that the types of questions, the types of techniques, questions asked, techniques used, and types of answers one is looking for are basically different in the two venues. But here, they're the same, because there's a natural equivalence that lets you pass back and forth between one of these truncated tuplets operators and one of these truncated Hankel forms, which means that the two different toolkits one knows classically about tuplets operators and about Hankel forms can both be brought to bear, as can the more or less standard list of questions one wants to ask. This equation is just an unpacking of the definitions. Notice the thing on the left is holomorphic in F and G, because C is conjugate holomorphic. So if you have the thing on one side, you can use it to if you have the B, you can define the A this way. If you have the A, you can define the B this way. Which means that all sorts of questions about the form or about the operator can be comfortably carried out, worked on in either venue. So does it have finite rank? Is it trace class? Does it have a bounded symbol, et cetera? What are these truncated Hankel forms? By the previous transparency, the rank one truncated tuplets operators will now give us truncated Hankel forms. The thing on the top right is the canonical example of a rank one Hankel form. Namely, you want a linear functional that only depends on the product. That linear functional is the product evaluated as zeta. The second guy is a little more subtle and has no classical analog. You take the conjugate, you take the conjugation applied to F, conjugation applied to G, evaluate the product at a point, and then take the complex conjugate. So if Z is, if theta is n plus 1, a classical Hankel matrix on the Hardy space is with the monomial basis, also has a structural description. It's striped this way. And again, the truncated guy is just what happens when you take the matrix and you pull off the upper left-hand square. On the theta sub 2A space, this is the kind of thing you get. Classically, when looking at Hankel forms, one would look at something like this, not something like this, one would look at exactly this kind of expression, where F hat and G hat were supported on the half line. Now we're looking at this kind of thing where F hat and G hat are supported in the interval minus A to A. So there's an implicit limit on the range of integration, but we can just have it buried inside the F hat and G hat. So because of the equivalence questions for truncated tuplets operators and Hankel forms are equivalent. So what are some questions? One question is, if the operator is bounded, does it have a bounded symbol? Recall that for classical, classical tuplets operators, the operator was bounded if and only if the symbol was bounded. For Hankel forms, B sub B, there was a longer discussion that involved BMO and things like that if you wanted to study the natural symbol, the holomorphic symbol. So does it, given one of these forms or operators, if it's bounded, is there a bounded symbol? And in the finite dimensional case, the question is trivial, but it's only trivial if you don't want to get estimates. If I start with a classical tuplets operator or a Hankel form and I restrict to the subspace K, I get an operator or a form with norm no larger. So in particular, if I have a bounded symbol, then the TTO or the THF is bounded. So far I haven't said anything. So here's a real theorem. This is Saracen's commutant lifting theorem from 1967. It says, given our setup, a K and a theta, given a scalar alpha mod alpha less than 1 and a phi that's holomorphic. So the functioning part of the hypothesis is that phi is holomorphic. In the truncated tuplets operator, a phi is bounded if and only if there's a bounded analytic function psi, which generates the same operator, and the operator norm of a phi is the L infinity norm of psi. And this is the thing I had in mind when I said earlier that the statement I just circled is sufficiently clean so you might speculate it has an elementary proof, and in fact it does. this theorem is sufficiently clean, so you might expect the same thing, but it's not true. Saracen's commutatum lifting theorem is a very subtle result, which turned out to open a large number of doors into areas that are still being very actively explored. Couldn't resist, moral obligation. This next thing is, that's theta bar. This is not a holomorphic symbol. It's not covered by the first part. But it's not holomorphic, but it's a special type of non-holomorphic. Namely, it's a certain structural form. It's holomorphic plus alpha theta bar times the same holomorphic function. In this case, you can read off that the operator has a bounded form. Is bounded. It's bounded if and only if there's psi, which is a bounded holomorphic function. So putting psi where phi is gives me the same operator, in which case the norm of the operator is the norm of psi. This, at some level, is just an observation. And the observation is that there's a change of variables that takes you from A phi, which is a truncated tuples operator on K, from A, so this complicated thing, truncated tuples operator on K, to an A sub phi itself, which is a truncated tuples operator with a different K. It's the change of variables in the Blaschke product, and then you get a new K, and then you carry everything over, and then you invoke the commutatum lifting theorem, and you get this. So one point is it's a class of operators for which you actually have a norm statement. The other reason I mentioned it is one of the early things in the theory of tuples operators, going back to Brown and Hamos, says if you take two tuples operators and you take their product, here are two questions. Might that be a tuples operator? Might it be the tuples operator with symbol F times G? And might it be this guy? So when do they commute, and when is the product of tuples operators the tuples operator? And Brown and Hamos said that the obvious cases where this can happen, for example, if both F and G are holomorphic, are the only cases. This comment here is that the Brown-Hamos theorem has to be replaced by something more subtle. In this case, the operators of this type form a commutative subalgebra of the truncated tuples operators, and that can be studied in its and that's some work of a student of mine who finished a couple of years ago, Nick Sedlock. And once you have the statements 1 and 2, the corresponding statements for the adjoints, the adjoint of A phi is A phi bar, read off the statement. But life is not so simple mathematically, and life is not so simple in the sociology of mathematics. One didn't used to have quite so many names in the list of authors. Anyhow, these guys, Saracen said, if you have a truncated tuples operator, you know the operator is bounded, must it have a bounded symbol? And in his paper, 97, it's sort of clear that he'd really taken a swat at that problem and not been able to resolve it. So it was a conjecture with some sort of degree of anger behind it. Anyhow, so they sorted this out. The answer is not always. If I'm given a theta, it's not just a finite Blaschke product. And a point zeta on the boundary, and a p bigger than 2, so k zeta is not an LP, then this rank 1 TTO does not have a bounded, is bounded and does not have a bounded symbol. So let me unpack this a little. First of all, I before said here are the two types of rank 1 TTOs. If the point evaluation at a boundary point is continuous on the space, then the two types associated with that point are scalar multiples of each other and scalar multiples of this guy. So, if point evaluation of the zeta on the boundary is bounded, then that thing, k zeta, tensor k zeta, is a rank one truncated tuples operator that is bounded. Secondly, it's automatic, just by Hilbert space theory, that K zeta is an L2. So the question is it in anything better than L2? The answer, the statement is, if it's not, then there's the operator without the bounded symbol. And this looks like it's not so useful until you go into the literature. And there are classical results that give you straightforward recipes for building all sorts of examples where K zeta is not an LP. And the point is, this condition on a sequence of points Zi ensures that the Blaschke product converges, and the appropriate K zeta will be an L2. But you can write down conditions on the Zi's that ensure that it's not in LP, and then you can do variations of that. So, remember we had this H2 tensor H2. This is the same thing with H2 theta. Namely, sums of products of things in H2 theta, where the sum of product norm Fi, norm Gi, is finite. And we take all those such, and we just denote the set of such by that dot symbol. I also want to introduce the Carlson measures at this point. A Carlson measure for one of these K spaces, and in fact, let me do it for all P. I only need it for P equals 1 and 2. But for any P, there's this HP theta, namely the functions, smooth functions of the right orthogonality type, and then you take the closure in HP. And if I then take a measure that lives in the disk and including on the boundary, I can ask if that HP space, which is substantially smaller than the full HP space, if the natural restriction map of functions in HP theta, they have boundary values, they have interior values, I can restrict and get a densely defined map into LP mu, LP mu, and that map is bounded or it's not, and if it is bounded, we say that mu is a Carlson measure. So if we were back in the classical case, that is the definition of Carlson measures. So here's a theorem. Baranov, Bessonov, Kapustin. Three things are equivalent. First of all, H2 dot H2 is H1. This is the classical statement that comes from inner Euler factorization. I possibly shouldn't have put an equal sign there because I certainly don't want to claim an isometric equality. This is the things you get by closing up in the L1 norm. Those things can be gotten as sums of products of things you got by closing up in the L2 norm. The definition has infinitely many, but by doing some work, you can show it always. You can always get by with four, and the reason is these spaces K still have some vestiges of the inner Euler factorization kind of machinery. Every positive function in the real part of K is the square of a modulus of something. Statements like that. Two, E2 theta squared equals E1 theta squared. So what's going on? There's the Fourier transforms to the Hardy space. There's the axis corresponding to index. I suppose this is not just the Hardy space. This is all of L2. And there's 0. And the Hardy space are the positive frequencies. Let me talk about the polynomials. The polynomial space says you go out here to some number n, and you look at things with frequencies on that strip. If you're going to start doing a kind of analysis that includes complex conjugation or taking real parts, then you end up also with the negative frequencies. So you end up looking at things with frequencies in that range. And now, depending on your point of view, at a certain level, this is the Hankel operator picture. And if I take everything and flip it upside down, I've still got the same interval, but then I move it 2 units over to the right, and I get the 0 to 2n range, and that's the Toeplitz operator picture. And the point is that moving it over now involves theta squared, and that's why this theta squared is showing up here. Right. If you take the product of two polynomials of degree less than n, the product has something to do with polynomials of degree less than 2n. So this theta squared kind of shows up naturally. And this is the statement that the H1 Carlson measures and the H2 Carlson measures for these subspaces are the same. And I mentioned earlier that the fact that they're the same in the classical case is part of the machinery. It's not soft analysis comment. And of course, where all this is going is this. If either one or equivalently two holds, then every truncated Toeplitz operator on K theta has a bounded symbol. So there's a class for which we're okay. Digression. These statements, H theta tensor H theta, H2 theta tensor H2 theta is H1 theta squared, those are clean looking statements when you actually instantiate them in the simplest possible cases. They're not transparent. So here's a theorem by Volberg. This theorem, to prove this independently of truncated Toeplitz operators or anything, but this statement holds if theta is e to the n plus 1, in which case it becomes the statement that given any polynomial of degree 2n, you can write it as a sum of products of polynomials of degree n, which you can obviously do or easily do, but you can do it so that you have the norm control, that the sum over J of the products of the L2 norms is controlled by the L1 norm of P. And then, in fact, you can get it with 4 sum-ands, and in fact, it's not known if you can get this result with 1 sum-and. Another result in the same spirit is if you apply this to these Paley-Wiener type spaces, the Paley-Wiener space is a space of functions of exponential type alpha, which are square interval on the line. Instantiating the result in this case becomes a statement about taking a given function of exponential type 2 alpha, writing as a sum of products of functions of exponential type alpha, entire functions. So you have this kind of norm control. And in their paper, Baranoff, et cetera, included a proof of this to make the point that you didn't need their whole machinery to get this. If you decide you want to prove this, you can prove it with bare hands and classical techniques. But their other point was it's more than just an observation. It's actually a statement that requires proof. Anyhow, back to our story. These were supposed to show separately. I said that these K spaces or the K theta spaces played an important role in various things and had been studied rather intensively from an analytic point of view. Alexandrov is one of the people who's done a lot of the work. And one of the things he proved is if you have a single component inner function, then all these EPs coincide. EPs are the space of Carlson measures for HP sub theta. So in particular, if you have a single component inner function, then every bounded truncated Toeplitz operator on K theta has a bounded symbol. So, how do you prove these things? Saracen's paper was titled Algebraic Theory of Truncated Toeplitz Operators. He used mainly an algebra, an analysis based on algebra, functional analysis, and relatively elementary complex analysis. And that was enough, for example, to get the characterization of the finite rank TGOs, which is a painful proof. Says a bunch of straightforward things, then says now we have to consider cases and consider 7 different cases. But it all works out at the end. And there have been a number of people who followed this paper in the same tradition, the mix of algebra and functional analysis. However, as I just said, there are places where substantial analytical tools get used. Alexandrov's theorem as an example, and this is what I said earlier. The space theta H2 is invariant under the forward shift operator, under multiplication by the coordinate function. And hence the orthogonal complement, K theta, is an invariant subspace for the adjoint operator, the star shift, the backward shift that moves the coefficients to the left one unit. And that space has been studied, that space and operators wanted to show up in model theory and have been studied a great deal. There's a book that's now a little oldish by Seaman and Ross called The Backward Shift on the Hardy Space. And the cliched comment about it is Alexandrov's papers are great mathematics and very hard reading, and you should look at this book first. Questions? It is plausible that if every bounded tupless operator has a bounded symbol, then you have a single component inner function, but that's just, it's not a conjecture, it's just speculation. Finite rank TTOs. What's frustrating is Saracen presents some natural classes of finite rank TTOs that, to me, look and smell like they should be the full story. And Dan Luking has done some things on finite rank Bergman space tuples operators that seem relevant, but this is just a nice question. I said earlier that the tuples operator theory and the Hankel operator theory both come with their own traditional toolboxes and traditional bunch of questions. The Schotten ideal theory has been studied extensively for the Hardy space context, and so questions in that area are, in addition to describing the finite rank operators, what are the Hilbert-Schmidt, either operators or forms, what are the trace class ones? One interesting vestige of the classical theory comes through again, and that is the space of all compact operators is the norm closure of the space of rank one operators. For these truncated Toeplitz operators, the space of compact ones is the norm closure of the rank one truncated Toeplitz operators. That's not just the pushing words around, that actually is a statement that requires a proof, and it's true in the Hardy space, and it's true here. That is the first statement in a bunch of theorems, Adamyanarov-Kreen. A very surprising relationship between the Schotten ideal theory of these kind of, well, the classic case of the Hankel operators. The Schotten ideal theory is about questions of the form, what's the best finite rank approximation to a certain operator? And what AAK show is that that is not intimately related to, but essentially equivalent to the question of solving and understanding the solution to a function theoretic extremal problem. You're given a function space with a norm, and you want to, in that function space, find the best approximation to a target function where the thing you're approximating with has, let me just say, complexity n, whatever that's going to mean. Well, these questions are all quite specific. Here are some broader issues. One doesn't know what the Carlson measures look like. And one doesn't know when they have bounded symbols, except the result I just showed you, and doesn't have much of a clue what happens in other more general cases. And one would like to describe these product spaces and their duals. In the classical case, this is H1 and BMO. But it is known there are cases where it's not H1 and BMO. Namely, as soon as you have a truncated Toeplitz operator with an unbounded symbol, then H2 is not going to be H1. I said sometimes the point evaluations on the boundary are continuous. If theta is a finite Blaschke product, then boundary convergence is a trivial issue. But as soon as theta is a Blaschke product with infinitely many zeros or a singular inner function, boundary convergence is quite delicate of functions in K theta near the points where the zeros accumulate or the singular measure has some mass. And those issues are still not understood. But before casually tossing these things out to students, there's a paper by Nazarov, Volberg about 10 years ago. They were trying to understand the two-weight Norman inequalities for the Hilbert transform, and they said this is very intimately related to a problem of characterizing the Carlson measures for these K thetas. And I offer that as two things, as indication that these questions are related to other things that are being actively studied, but that you should be careful before giving these questions to students, for example. Well, that's all I wanted to say, except that. The Nazarov-Volberg paper was sensitive to the fact that Saracen had a conjecture and Nazarov had a counterexample. And I think the Nazarov-Volberg paper is in that intellectual tradition. Now, I don't know if that answers your question. Now, I know that that doesn't particularly answer the question, because this whole modern truncated Tuppets operator thing really was a bunch of isolated examples till Saracen wrote this paper in 1997. And I know enough of the people who are active in it to suspect the answer to your question is no. Curiously, I don't understand the Fields Institute. Even as we speak, there's a conference in the next building on Blaschke products, and Bill Ross is over there, and is one of the people who's thought a lot about these things and might know more. I don't think they're not known. You can take the Paley-Wiener space. This is one way you can do it, and I think there are other ways also. You say the Fourier transform lives on here. I do a this. Namely, I multiply by those guys, and then I get three things, one of which is cut off here and looks like has all the singularity properties of a Hardy space function. The other guy looks like the conjugate of a Hardy space function, and the guy inside is tame. And using that, you can patch together a fair number of the classical things, Muckenhalt, Weitz, this, that, and the other. And Christian Seid has done a lot of things, and I haven't read them.